Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Terry. On today's show, the Kansas City Star has undertaken a new statewide journalism project in Missouri this year in partnership with the National Service Program, Report for America, and sponsored by Missouri Foundation for Health on the topic of gun violence prevention. Jaws of Justice host Pat Bartholomew will discuss the project with the Report for America journalist Caitlin Washburn and Jelani Gibson and a member of the KC Star editorial board, Toriano Porter. They will explain the initiative and how to get involved. In the second half of the hour, I'll speak with Bev Livingston, founders of Mothers of Incarcerated Sons and Daughters, and Janae Relaford Davis, founder CEO of Camp Choice, Children Having Opportunities in Creating Environment, on the topic of black-on-black crime. This is not a new topic for Bev and Janae. Knowing, caring people discuss this topic 365 days of the year. Crime is high in black neighborhoods. According to the Bureau for Justice Statistics, people living in households with income below the poverty threshold are twice as likely to commit a violent crime than people in high-income households, regardless of race. The fact there is crime in black neighborhoods does not make police violence okay or understandable. We live in a country where the poverty rate is more than twice as high among black Americans than white, largely as a result from 400 years of racism. Thank you for listening to Jaws of Justice. We will not see justice unless those who are unaffected are as outraged as those who are.
Good morning. Welcome to Jaws for Justice. Thank you for tuning in this morning. My name is Pat Bartholomew, and I'm going to be hosting this important show on gun violence and the initiatives to solve gun violence, including what the Kansas City Star has decided to do. Our guests this morning are Jelani Gibson, Caitlin Washburn, are both journalists and members of Report for America 2020 class, and I'm going to ask them to talk to you about that. They were hired by the Kansas City Star very recently, specifically to develop the gun violence initiative. Our last guest is Toriano Porter, who's a Kansas City opinion writer, two-time author, speaker, mentor, and a member of the Kansas City Star editorial board. So I'm going to start off by saying to Jelani, can you talk a little bit about your background, your journalism experience, why this topic interests you, and how you got to Missouri?
Well, I have a background getting started in the United States Air Force as a photojournalist. After I was put on a military base in Texas, I decided that I liked the Lone Star State so much that I should stay there. And so I got out of the military in Texas and I became an education reporter at a small town paper. And then after that, I went to grad school, and it was from grad school that I was recruited into Report for America.
Caitlin, can you talk a little bit about your background and journalism experience and why this topic interested you?
Yeah, I grew up in Southern California, but I came out here for journalism school. I went to the Missouri School of Journalism for school. During that time, I had short stints of doing journalism all over the country. And then this last year, I got involved with Report for America, which is a national service organization aimed at bolstering local journalism and improving coverage of undercovered issues. And my first stint with Report for America brought me back to California, but to the Central Valley to cover agriculture. And so I spent a year doing that. And then I applied for a new position and I got this one. It's a pretty sweet project to be involved in, to not just be one, but of three reporters covering this issue in an in-depth and a wide sweeping way across the state. And it's a really cool opportunity to cover a seriously varied issue with a lot of nuance to it.
Yeah, and it is a statewide initiative, which I think is, it's great because obviously as I, who know the history of Missouri, Kansas City, Springfield, and St. Louis all have rated some of the one of the top 12 dangerous cities in the nation. So it is obviously a statewide problem. I'm going to ask Toriano, you're the senior person here. You obviously are senior at the table here. What kind of, where do we ask people that are brand new to this state? You come from St. Louis with your own history of being affected by gun violence. What do we, how would you suggest a starting point for your colleagues here during this really seminal moment?
Wow. Well, I'll tell you what, Caitlin and Jelani has hit the ground running here in Kansas City, making the connections with the people they may make connections with. So my advice to those young people would be continue to do what you're doing. I'm inspired by working with them. Like, I'm really inspired by the go get them attitude and the focus and the intelligence of this, this initiative. So I'm just here to lend a hand. I'm not a senior or anything. I'm just here to lend a hand and a voice. And I think that voice is going to be very important as the news side and editorial side teams up with Report for America. I think this is going to be a great, great way to bring attention to what is a not only a growing gun violence problem, but one that's really has reached epidemic proportions all over the state.
Right. And as we know, every single day the ground is shifting. On Sunday, the Kansas City Star, and I'm a proud subscriber, did a opinion set part piece on the fact that there's now 103 homicides in Kansas City in the first 6 months of 2020. That's dizzying statistic.
Yes,
it's a terrible statistic.
It's a terrible statistic, and one of the hardest things I had to do this year was put that list together. I had to put that list of the 103 homicide victims together for the editorial board and put it online and put it in our paper. And that was humbling because I know that feeling. And that's 103 families that have been destroyed. And that's just in 6 months. That's humbling and that's terrifying.
And actually, I just went through the list and counted just, you know, you could subgroup this in any number of ways, but I decided to look at the people that were under 25, and there were 22, which I think that's one of the issues about this issue is there's so much misunderstanding about it. This issue is a whole lot wider than just what we see as young people's issue. It's much more global. It's not a monolithic issue, is it? There's domestic violence issues here at play. There's mental health issues. Crime is a small part of the equation, which leads me to wonder if, you know, we just got up this morning and discovered that we were going to have the federal government in our community with something called Operation Legend. Who wants to speak to that?
I can speak on that.
Good.
You know, first and foremost, it's important to note that the homicides just aren't rising, that in certain demographics, the suicides are rising as well. And one of the reasons why this project appealed to me is because both as, you know, an African-American male and also as a veteran, whether you want to talk about homicides or suicides, I happen to be a part of two demographics that are disproportionately affected by that issue. And so it's very important to note that in many demographics, gun violence overall is increasing. And what it appears to me that the response to much of this is that we are weaponizing mechanics of law enforcement to respond to socioeconomic issues. And that seems like a rather flawed approach of treating the symptoms as opposed to the causes. Law enforcement should and does play an important role in reducing violence, but it's not the only role that our government should give funding to in order to reduce violence, in my analytical opinion.
And actually, if you look at a book that's really worth looking at, and it's called The History of Racism in Kansas City, from the very beginning, the Kansas City Police Department did not do enough to protect the rights or physical well-being of Black people. They showed indifference toward the ghetto. If one African-American had murdered another, there was very little investigation. And so police didn't care for about Black victims. And when murder is ignored, what better incentive could there be for the perpetration of such acts? That's a quote from this book. But I think and I know, Jelani, you had mentioned too, the issue of the local protests that clearly are a direct correlation with how people are treated by the police. And so who wants to talk about that?
Well, I'll jump in there here. When I first heard about Operation Legend, my initial thoughts was that's overreach. It's heavy-handed. And what does that say about your local police department? What does that say about your local law enforcement officials? I also believe it's politically based. The city of Kansas City, the last thing you need is increased police presence, more officers, more law enforcement. Like Jelani said, like we've been discovering here, you need more resources on the ground to attack the root issue, which is poverty, lack of access to health, things of that nature, socioeconomic issues. I'm disheartened by it. The fact that our mayor didn't know it was happening, our police department didn't know it was coming, that screams politics to me. And as you know, Black and brown people take the brunt of over-policing. Even in this position that I am in, I'm still worried about my safety when it comes to law enforcement officials in this town because of the lack of accountability. Now you bring the federal government in here, there's no accountability.
Yeah, I think it's sort of one of those this is the best of time and worst of time quotes. That's, you know, from the Tale of Two Cities that was required reading back in high school. But it does speak to the fact that while we have this horrifying amount of violence going on, we have seen a glimmer of hope in the fact that people have come together and people of different demographics have decided to get involved in the Black Lives Matter. I certainly hope that's something that people feel comfortable talking about. I think it's a very important issue.
I can talk about that. The Black Lives Matter protest movement, much like the protest movements that took place in the 60s, are a direct response to what the current young generation has decided, that they live in a country that has not provided the amount of civil rights protections and standard of living that should be afforded to every single citizen. Criticism that can often be leveled towards young people is, young people are easily offended. But if you look at that in a generational context, every generation is offended by something. You know, if you look back in the 60s or 50s, you know, we used to be offended by Black people drinking at water fountains and going to schools. And so this whole conversation of who is and is not offended by something, or who is the most offended generation, I believe that that is sometimes used to dismiss the concerns of a particular generation. And so when you talk about the specific generation that I'm in and the younger generation, what this movement, which is made up of a multitude of generations with a large amount of young people leading that charge, young people are saying that they are offended by what they see to be as America's failure to implement the American dream and promise and provide that opportunity in an equal manner, specifically as it relates to how Black people live in this country. When you consider the history of our country, the mere thought of Black people being human in and of itself is actually a very new concept. I can walk down the street on any given Sunday and walk into somebody or run into somebody who is literally older than the entire acknowledged existence of my ethnicity's humanity. And so that literally lets you know that we are not a far, you know, this, you know, when we talk about the things like the Klan and racism or structural racism, a lot of these things didn't take place back in the day. And also when you talk about civil rights, what civil rights leaders like Martin Luther King said as they were marching was. The civil rights movement was supposed to be a beginning and not an end. And that's what it was always meant to do. And, you know, you can even look at it from a basic mathematical perspective. I mean, you know, if you proceed to destroy someone at 1,000% and you only heal them at 20 or 50, there's going to be a lot of upset people. You know, you can't, what this country has done, what this country has historically done to the Black community is what I would call an enthusiasm gap. You know, this country was enthusiastic about slavery. It was enthusiastic about segregation. It was enthusiastic about denying people rights. It was enthusiastic all the way to the point where we had a war that was over it. And it's also very instructive to let people know that the most deadliest war that we fought wasn't when we were fighting overseas. It was when we were fighting ourselves over the ability to deny other people rights. And so if that's
slow.
Yeah. Hey,
you're killing them this morning.
If that isn't instructive as to why people are still upset in 2020, you have to take all of that history and context. If I have to ask you for civil rights, if I have to ask you to be recognized as a human being, but I don't have to ask you to enslave me, I don't have to ask you to segregate me, I don't have to ask you to deny me my rights, I don't have to ask you to deny, you know, the right to be a citizen in this country at multiple points in this country's history. It works like any other relationship. It works like any other human relationship, right? You know, if I go into my employer's office and my employer has to ask me to show up to work on time, there's something wrong with that relationship.
Yeah.
Because my employer is literally asking me to do the minimum standard that has to be done. And so if a particular demographic of people live in this country where they've literally had to consistently fight for the government to do the minimum standard, then that lets you know that the relationship isn't where it needs to be. And, you know, when you talk about things like, you know, the war on drugs or the war on crime and things of that nature, which you slowly, you know, start to begin. Which you slowly start to realize, and I'm also very aware of this as a veteran, is that when you look at the wars that we wage, the wars that we're enthusiastic about waging, disproportionately have Black and brown people as collateral. But the wars that we've always had to ask the minimum standard for in terms of equality and rights, those are not wars that this country has been historically enthusiastic about. And so until the Black community and you know, other minority communities are as enthusiastically helped out by this government as enthusiastically as they were basically disenfranchised, until that enthusiasm gap is breached.
Yeah, I like that term, and I'm going to remember that enthusiasm gap.
Yeah.
Well, you know, there's a couple other things I think I want to talk about before we run out of time, but there's so many issues. You brought up some really good points. And I always think of Frederick Douglass saying, if there's no struggle, there's no progress. You know, so this is a struggle. And our concern, and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar just did a great opinion piece yesterday talking about, we don't want this to go away and peter out, this energy. So I'm hoping it will stay, you know, that we'll be able to continue to encourage people to move forward. Because as my reaction to gun violence, it's the tip of the sword. I mean, it's symptomatic of a whole wide range of issues that we have to address. Please, Caitlin.
Well, these are the conversation that we're having both on our team and with the sources we're connecting with is getting at these institutional failures and understanding the root causes. And Operation Legend is one example, but also with Parson signing the bill strengthening penalties for gun crimes, is that generated an interesting conversation with us, which was, what does it mean to be tough on crime? We're in a state where for the last two decades, there have been significant rollbacks on gun laws and sensible gun measures. And so how do you actually address the symptom or the root cause of this issue without also recognizing the institutional failures? And so, as Jaylani so well pointed out, is that's what we're thinking about all the time. We're not just talking with people who obviously live through this every day, but also learning about the history and putting this into context so that people understand how this, the root cause of gun violence, is so much more nuanced than just someone having a gun or someone getting in a fight. And we were, and Jaylani brought up suicide, and that the issue of gun violence does not leave any community in Missouri exempt. You look at rural towns, you look at small towns, there are, you might not have the homicide issue that you see in St. Louis, Kansas City, and Springfield, but you absolutely have gun violence. It takes just a different form. And it takes the form of domestic violence, of family violence, of suicide, of unintentional shootings, of kids getting a hold of guns. You know, those numbers aren't going to go down until the root causes are addressed.
Well, I also thought the Star this morning did a great sort of very quick history on gun legislation in this state, and how you're absolutely right. For the last 5 or 6 years, unfortunately, the General Assembly has kept chipping away at some very kind of common sense gun control issues. And I guess, again, you know, I'm afraid we're in a state where the Second Amendment is, you know, sacrosanct, and we absolutely, anything that comes close to the Second Amendment makes everybody get up in arms. But the other thing I want somebody to talk about, you know, why local journalism? I mean, here we are, you're journalists, and I applaud you for becoming journalists, because the whole ground is shifting in how we get our news. And so, you know, how many 1,200 local papers have gone out of existence in the last, actually, it's gotten worse with the pandemic. So why has journalism got a role here?
The old saying goes, democracy dies in darkness. I mean, we're the gatekeepers of, we're the third, fourth protection for the people, what they call it, the fourth estate. We're the voice of the people. Local journalism is important because you can get your news about president from any source, Washington Post, New York Times, LA Times. But when you want to know what's going on with Kansas City, you need to support your local journalism. And that's because we're on the ground, whether it's 200 of us or 20 of us. We're on the ground, we're meeting the people, we're in the trenches, we know the establishments, we know the institutions, we know who to hold accountable. And that's our job. And I absolutely love what I do, and I'm sure these guys love what they do, to hold the powerful accountable for the taxpayers and the people. That's a blessing. And I think your listeners and our readers, I think they need to understand how important that is, because if we lose our news sources, the politicians in this town, the powerful are going to run amok.
Yeah, and actually, there was a woman who, when this first became a national issue, that it really started talking about the fact that the news industry was drying up badly because of advertising dollars. And, you know, there was one woman that got on and she talked about what really happens to community when you don't have local news. She was saying, you know, we don't really realize how much of our civic life and community life, like getting people to vote and caring about voting and just caring about what's going on in their neighborhood. You don't have a news source. It really does impact the life and health of the community. I'm going to end this show by asking each of you to sort of give an assignment to our listeners. What do you want from our community? What's going to make your job not easier, but certainly make an impact on the community? How can we help you? And anybody can jump in.
Well, you can, I mean, your voices and your insights can do a lot to inform our reporting. If you have a story to tell, if you have an insight to share, if you have someone that we really need to talk to, or something we have to read immediately, please feel free to send that our way. We've got an email address you can get to us at, which is gunviolencekcstar.com. You can give us a call too at 816-226-7746. we'd love to hear any insights you have to share or any stories, you know, however it relates to this issue or what we've talked about today.
I think that's an excellent idea. There's a group in town called More Squared that has taken on a very active role in reforming the Kansas City, Kansas Police Department. And they have come up with some, I'd say, some very impactful ways to get people to come forward and talk about their concerns about their police department. So I might suggest that people look into that as well. I suspect we're out of time. Anyway, thank you all for coming and talking. I hope this was a good session for you. It certainly was for me. I appreciate your insight and input and look forward to talking to you again. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now the calendar for the week of July 13th. In compliance with the latest version of Mayor Lucas' emergency order, certain business activities may resume while ensuring necessary public health measures remain in place. See the facts at kcmo.gov. In opposition to the executions next week, Missourians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty will host an execution watch and vigil on Monday, July 13th, Wednesday, July 15th, and Friday, July 17th from 2:30 to 3:30 p.m. in front of the Federal Courthouse in Kansas City, Missouri, 400 East 9th Street. You would be welcome to stand with Missouri Alternative to the Death Penalty staff at the press conference to protest these federal executions. Staff will be there all three dates. Masks will be worn and physical distancing observed. If you're unable or do not feel comfortable meeting in person, there'll be a live virtual vigil. The link is on Facebook at Death Penalty Action. Your Fellow Americans documentary and discussion series, sponsored by the Central Library, 14 West 10th, Kansas City, Missouri, will be Monday, July 13th at 6:30 p.m. They want you to feel encouraged to discuss the sensitive subjects of racism, prejudice, and immigration in calm conversation. Go to kansascityeventful.com for no charge tickets. Demanding Women will be Monday, Quarantine Conversations About Gun Violence, 1 p.m., July 13th, an online event. Join Shannon Watts, founder of Moms Demand Actions, and Representative Karen Bass about how gun violence, police violence, and the COVID pandemic disproportionately impact Black people. Access information at acteverytown.org. Moms Demand Missouri, Kansas City Virtual Monthly Meeting is Monday, July 13th, 7 p.m. Access info at act.everytown.org. Wyandotte County Moms Demand Action Virtual Meeting is 6:30 p.m. Monday, July 13th. Access information at act.everytown.org. Douglas County Moms Demand Action Virtual Meeting is Thursday, July 16th, 6:30 p.m. Access information at act.everytown.org. On Tuesday, July 14th, Four Forms of Racism, 6:30 p.m. is an online event sponsored by Showing Up for Racial Justice KC, training to effectively confront, disrupt, and dismantle white supremacy. See SURJKC on Facebook. On Wednesday, July 15th, Local Elections and Juvenile Justice, 6 p.m., Facebook Live, Kansas Appleseed asks us to join Integrated Voter Engagement Director Caleb Smith and Just Campaign Director Mike Fonkert in an online discussion and forum about juvenile justice policy. Thursday, July 16th, The Power of the Prosecutor is 6 to 9 p.m., an online event, Let's Get Local Control of the Kansas City Police Department. Email outreachkc@aclu-missouri.org for more details. Thursday, July 16th, 1 to 2:30 p.m., Missouri has an important election coming up. Empower Missouri has an Empowering You webinar to discuss the election. Go to empowermissouri.org for access information. Please tune in next week when host Craig Lubo talks with Jean Peters Baker and Tracy Chapel about the upcoming Jackson County, Missouri District Attorney election. My name is Terry, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org, as well as the Jaws of Justice Facebook page. We want to thank our engineer today.
Every Tuesday from 6 to 6:30 p.m., Radioactive Magazine, a locally produced public affairs program, spotlights individuals and organizations in our community that deal with ideas and issues of social and political significance, such as climate change, racial and gender inequality, pay inequity, and much, much more. That's Radioactive Magazine, Tuesdays, 6 to 6:30 p.m., right here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Are clowns ashamed to use your old car, truck, or boat in their parade? Consider donating it and receive a tax deduction. 80% of the value of the sale will go to KKFI. Go to kkfi.org and click support.
August 4th is primary election day in Kansas and Missouri. The last day to register for this election in Kansas is July 14th. In Missouri, that deadline passed July 8th. Requests for mail-in ballots must be received by July 22nd in Missouri and July 28th in Kansas. This message is a public service of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Good morning. We're lucky today we have two guests in our studio.
Janae Relaford is on the phone, and Bev Livingston is live in the studio with me. Janae Relaford Davis grew up in Kansas City, and she graduated from Westport High School. She's attained a bachelor's degree in social work and a master's in social work, and she is the founder of Camp Choice. So, Janae, are you online with us?
I am.
Well, that is great. Yeah, good. And we have Bev Livingston present. And Bev Livingston, I'm sure many of our listeners will be familiar. She's the founder of Mothers of Incarcerated Sons and Daughters. And Bev has been very active in our community, and we're so lucky to have them both on with us. Bev, you want to say hello to our listeners?
Good morning.
And the topic that we're going to talk about today is black-on-black crime. So, ladies, take it away.
Well, this morning we want to really address some of the situations that might cause some of the violence in our community. And we also want to talk about some alternatives to not being so quick to pick up the gun and weapons and injure each other by learning how to just not escalate situations and learn some solutions for de-escalating. As we know, most anthropologists would define culture as the shared set of implicit and explicit values, ideas, concepts, and rules of behavior that allow a social group to function and perpetuate itself. In our community, we have become very limited in the male figure. We have boys in our community, and we have old men in our community. And between that age of 12 years and 60 years, there's a missing group. And those men have been incarcerated. They have been killed by violence. And because of some of the younger people who have been so into playing video games, and we're not trying to do the blame game right now, but there is no reset button in real life. So, Janae, I'd like to give you an opportunity to just kind of take it away with what you feel are some of the systemic and institutionalized issues that are part of the narrative now, and how we want to try to control that narrative and make a change.
I really appreciate this opportunity, and I first want to address the pain of Black America, because this topic is extremely sensitive, and I really want to respect that for my people. 246 years of slavery, 100 years of segregation, and honestly, we're still segregated today, and we still have separate and unequal schools, and, you know, the mass incarceration, all this has weighed heavy on the Black community for generations. And so what we're seeing with the black-on-black crime is definitely a symptom of something much deeper that really needs a lot of attention from, you know, starting within our homes, of course, but we know that so many homes suffer to be able to provide that, you know, development that children really need, young people really need, because that's where it's starting. And this is a population that it is really impacting, is our youth, as you stated earlier. The subject is so deep, so I wanted to kind of start with the term black-on-black crime, because from me sharing my concerns about it in the community, I have gotten a lot of, you know, concerning responses from people in the black community about the term. I mean, many feel that it's a myth, you know, and, you know, I've done some research on this, and, you know, the argument is, you know, there's white-on-white crime, you know, Hispanic-on-Hispanic, Asian-on-Asian. Races kill within their race. So the black-on-black is a myth to some people. But as I do more research and as I see, you know, within my hometown that I grew up in, Kansas City, I used to be the vice president of the Ad Hoc Group Against Crime, and, you know, I'm a witness that, you know, homicide within the black community, crime within the black community, and poor communities. We know poverty breeds crime and violence. So, but yes, it's heightened. You know, homicide levels are heightened for us. In fact, last year, Kansas City was deemed the fifth most dangerous big city in the country by SafeWise. And as we know, we have Operation Legend, you know, hitting the streets, in which our mayor, Q, is saying that, you know, these 100 federal agents are not here to patrol or police our streets, but kind of to work behind the scenes, hopefully helping with the unsolved homicide rates. Because as, you know, hundreds of homicides pile up year after year, most of these homicides remain unsolved. So that's a huge issue that has to be dealt with. So, but I really want to get to the root of how people feel about all this, because another issue with what I feel and black communities feel is that people are looking at us as if we are inherently bad. It's something inherently wrong with black people. And a lot of white people feel this way. And I want to be honest about that. As I was doing some of my research, I ran across this article written in the American Renaissance by an editor named Jared Taylor. And I just have to share this, what he said. And he was touting all the statistics about black-on-black crime and how it's very perverse. And he said, for this reason alone, whites are justified in avoiding black neighborhoods and not wanting blacks to move into their neighborhoods. Of course, crime is not the only result when neighborhoods become black. Schools decline, housing decays, stores close, vandalism increases, and all the familiar signs of ghetto squalor begin to appear. It is probably not possible to bring black crime rates down to white level. So as long as black and whites continue to live together, whites will pay a high price of sharing their society with an inverted I had a little issue. I had to look this word up. Inveterately violent racial minority. And what inveterate means is having a particular habit, activity, or interest that is long established and unlikely to change. So what this writer is basically saying is there's no hope for us.
That's absolute nonsense.
Janae, you want to make sure you tell our listeners again, this is an article you read, and I certainly do not agree with the opinion of that writer. Was there any basis for fact, or was this all opinion?
Well, see, the basis for fact were the statistics. Because if you go online, you know, a lot of people in the black community also feel like these statistics are stats. You know, I mean, you can't, I couldn't find any articles that didn't share that homicide and crime in black communities is higher, you know, here locally within Kansas City, KCPD statistics. You can go on KCPD's website daily. They update homicide rates daily except for weekends. But we are, as of Friday, we were at 99 homicides. I didn't check it this morning to see what activity happened over the weekend. But, you know, and black males are over 60%. They represent over 60% of the suspect and the victims. I mean, the statistics are very concerning, which is why we have Operation Legend here. And but I want to make clear, because I want to, you know, I know time goes so fast, and I feel like I'm taking over the show, but I don't want to miss the opportunity to talk about solutions. I mean, we have to get to solutions with this. And so I'm hoping that, you know, this whole Operation Legend thing is just going to bring a bunch of federal agents here to work on unsolved homicides. You can't just put money into solving crime. You have to put money into preventing crime. You have to put money into intervening with the target population that this is impacting.
Yeah, let's talk about solutions. Bev, do you have some ideas on what can be done to change the culture in our black neighborhoods?
Well, I want to start by stating that this system that we're talking about and the narrative that we all are a part of right now is by design. It's not broken, and we can blame it on every male between the ages of 12 and 60 is a suspect. We are disrespected by the police. We can blame it on being held back through racism, systemic designs,
poverty, can't get a job.
Oh yeah, cop systems, school systems. But at the end of the day, the self-inflicted violence that we are dealing with in our community comes from the home life, the family, the lack of being embraced when basic needs are not being addressed and met. And I think that we must quit prosecuting our own and going after our own and thinking we're doing the right thing. We've got to make it better for the greater good. And that is some of what MIST does. MIST helps people become their own best advocate and know how to stand up to systems that are oppressing us. And I've been watching a lot of PBS public television shows that are showing things like suffrage and women voting and the movements, and a lot of it looks just like our young people who are in the street now protesting. So Janae, based on us knowing that this is not anything new, the family has always dealt with challenges of suffrage, even as far as slave days when crosses were burned in our yards, and our sisters and brothers in slavery, their homes, their shacks were burned, and they just walk away. And this was like collateral damages that people had to endure. So now, because we have things at the push of a button, we have online, we have Google. I don't know how Google has really become the smartest brain ever, but we need to utilize those things that we have at hand. And in terms of changing the narrative, Janae, do you want to talk about where we can start in terms of de-escalating what makes people so angry and want to end life with just the pull of a trigger or whatever?
Right. Well, first of all, you know, I spoke about intervention. Domestic violence is, you know, people need tools to deal with that. You know, we need to help people understand. We need to put messaging, you know, out that says, hey, don't shoot. Breathe, think, and speak your peace. You know, we have to teach people tools of how to de-escalate. But then we need some serious, well-funded educational programming, and it has to start with school-age youth. That's our prevention age group. And then we need interventions with our working-age youth, and I would take that all the way to age 30, you know, from 14 to 30 years old, and help them with educational program that emphasizes spirituality. I think that's a lot of what's missing with the programming that is available. First of all, we don't know how to market it, you know, correctly to the young people that we're trying to target. We see that every day in our community when we, you know, try to deliver efforts to help the community, and then we don't get a lot of response from the community. We have to learn how to market. We have to learn how to touch the people that is this is actually impacting. So, and, you know, we have to emphasize spirituality and historical and cultural educational methods that help individuals understand their place in the world. I mean, that these people are hurting. I mean, people that these, you know, people who are committing murder, you know, in our community, is something wrong. They need help. You know, I don't believe these people are just evil people. These people are hurting. They, like you said, have lived a life that they have not been nurtured. I mean, you think about the black man. Because as you said, Ms. Livingston, that's who's missing within our community, and it's so obvious. But you think about the black man. Now, it's one thing to not be nurtured by your family, but think about to not be nurtured by an entire society, that an entire society belittles you, degrades you, hates you, fears you, despises you, doesn't want you around, doesn't want to see you succeed. Can you imagine what that does to the black male psyche?
All right. Now, I pause right there. I understand what you're saying. And what I would like for us to do is address that woman that's heading the household, that's caring for the family, while that man between the age of 12 and 60 years old is absent from the home. And I'm going to give you an example of why we really need to repopulate our community with the black men who can help care for the family and head the family. There are 30 African-American men to 100 African-American females in the city of St. Louis. I did not get the numbers for here in Kansas City, but that's a huge disproportionate amount of male versus female. We need to have the family represent, whether that's same-sex family or heterosexual family or whatever, to begin inside the home, the core values that are needed to help go out and seek those community services and schools and institutions that are to help complement learning from home. Charity begins at home. I'm in old school, so you know, I just learned how if you don't get it at home, you're really not, you know, going to get it from the street, and what's done in the street should stay in the street. Home needs to be that sanctuary where people are encouraged and nurtured to go out and get the best that they can get for them and for the children that they have. As I begin to look at this thing changing, and I am seeing some change, I am seeing very high caliber, well-respected young men on television and on radio, and I'm hearing the voices of educated men who are saying, not all of us think like this. So as we try to get the attitudinal change out there and let that be and get ahead of the narrative and control the narrative, I believe that there is help for those mothers that just feel hopeless and helpless and have sons and daughters incarcerated who they are now caring for the children and trying to hold up the family until they come home. What is your message to those people, to us who have children and nephews and young people that we don't want them to grow up feeling what our men who are like 20 to 50 and 60 years old now who are coming home from incarceration and all they know is oppression? What would you say to those families and to those men and women?
Well, I would send them the message that, you know, I expressed through my work with Camp Choice, mm-hmm. you know, that connecting with the spirit, connecting with the creator of the spirit is vital to life, mm-hmm. is vital to any life.
Okay.
And if you feel lost in this world, that divine connection is everything you need to make it through. So surround yourself with people that you feel loving spirit energy with, and get some guidance.
Okay.
God, if you can't get it from your family, look, God always places people in our lives to give us what we need.
Amen, Janae. And I'm a firm believer in spiritual fitness, physical fitness, mental health fitness, and just be fit for the journey because there is so much ahead of us and the unknowns. Who would have thought we would be in a pandemic during 2020? You know, a year that we were to celebrate graduations and other things that had just been put on pause. So if that isn't an opportunity to just kind of stop, look and listen, and know that there is a higher power that's involved in this and that can lead us out of this, but people have to have that belief and understanding that this is greater than we are. The institutionalized racism needs community support in controlling the narrative. And I do see a cooperative attitude in many of my white brothers and sisters that I collaborate with and work with. They are on board with this. I saw white females on the front line of the protests, and I know how serious protests can be. I know it can go from a peaceful protest to a very angry, violent situation. So I now see races coming together and trying to work together, but that attitudinal change is much needed in terms of looking down on the brothers and saying, black men, you beware, you know, they're dangerous, they're this, they're that. I see that changing, and I just think that it is an important time for all of us to just kind of work together, join forces. And I so love Camp Choice. I saw how you had young people engaged in picking and choosing what kind of economic social status they want to have in the community, in life. And
Janae, would you be so good as to give us contact information for Camp Choice? Do you have a website?
I do have a website. Thank you so much. www.campchoicekc.com. Right now, we are really emphasizing our youth life coaching services. I can be contacted at area code 816-560-0977.
And Bev, you want to tell everybody, you said in passing MIST, that's Mothers of Incarcerated Sons and Daughters,
yes,
which is a great organization. How does a person contact your group?
We're at MISDKC.org, and our website has information about various opportunities and activities and how to get involved in the actions, from public policy, legislative lobbying work, to just the day-to-day opportunities that we have to prevent people from being incarcerated. We need some alternative sentencing, and we need to get people engaged in making a difference.
I think to talk about the fact that we're all aware that there's been a majority of blacks incarcerated, black men, is empowering. Mm-hmm. And I celebrate you both. This was a great show, and thank you for talking to our listeners today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Janae, do you have any final wrap-up words you'd like to leave with our listeners?
I really do. I would like to just say a little something about the little four-year-old legend Taliaferro. You know, the whole reason Operation Legend, I'm not going to say he's the whole reason that these federal agents are here, but they've named this after him, and he's Kansas City's 95th homicide. He was shot on June the 29th at the Citadel Apartments, which is at 6135 Blue Hills Road here in Kansas City, Missouri, 64110. And this happened in the wee hours of night while he slept in his bed, was shot in the face and killed. So there's a $25,000 reward for any information leading to arrest in his homicide, and that's 474-TIPS. And I just want to also emphasize the point of de-escalating anger. I mean, don't shoot could mean don't shoot a gun, you know, don't shoot your mouth off, you know, don't haul off and hit somebody. But, you know, when we're feeling anger rise up, which anger is a natural emotion, So anger is meant to tell us something. It's just like any other emotion, but we have to learn how to express that emotion appropriately.
Amen. So amen, Janae.
Yes, we want to breathe and we want to think about, you know, what we want to say and then say it.
All right. Well, we've got less than a minute left, and so we want to add, even though anger management falls under the mental health fitness, we want to add anger management as a fitness within itself, because that does drive a lot of things that happen. And I would like to invite anyone that wants to talk about or learn how or engage in becoming their own best advocate to visit misdkc.org and join us. We meet every second Saturday at the Plex Pod just down the street from here off 39th and Warwick, and we'd love to have you come. We are the solutions to our problems. Thank you.
It's the 420 Drug War News. Today we close out our coverage, our focus, our discussion with Michelle Alexander, author of The New Jim Crow.
I wrote the book in large part because I was so alarmed by the failure of the civil rights community to prioritize the war on drugs and the mass incarceration poor people of color in the United States. You would think that given the sheer scale of the drug war and of mass incarceration and its impact on the black community, that it would be the number one priority of every civil rights organization in the country, and that, you know, the African-American political leadership would be outspoken, calling for an end to the drug war. But instead, you know, there's been a relative quiet. You know, happily, the NAACP in recent years and under new leadership has become more vocal and aggressive in calling for an end to mass incarceration. But, you know, there has been an eerie quiet. Now, why? Well, I think there's many reasons for it, not the least of which is the fact that, you know, one of the primary strategies that racial justice advocates have used has been to try to identify those African Americans who defy racial stereotypes and try to, you know, attract public attention to them. You know, people like Rosa Parks. Try to identify those individuals who defy prevailing racial stereotypes and hold them up as examples of why the prevailing, you know, caste system, the prevailing system of discrimination is unfair and unjust and should be eradicated. You know, where the prevailing system of control criminalizes the black community, that strategy of distancing yourself from kind of the so, quote-unquote worst elements of your community and trying to shine a light on those who are, you know, the most noble within the community doesn't work so well. So there's been, you know, a reflexive tendency in the African-American community to try not to draw public attention to those within the community, you know, that have gotten into trouble or who might look bad. The plight of those cycling in and out of the criminal justice system, unfortunately, hasn't been a top priority, but issues like affirmative action have topped the list. The efforts of, you know, struggling, you know, African-American students to get into the best high schools and colleges have been a higher priority. But, you know, as civil rights organizations have agonized over affirmative action, millions of people of color have been rounded up, branded felons, and relegated to a permanent second-class status.
Thank you, Michelle Alexander. Please read her book, The New Jim Crow. I am Dean at DrugTruth.net.
Sitting here in my problem. What am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it? Some way, somehow. Well, maybe I'm not supposed to know.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcasts on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. This is Jamie reminding you our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD.